You have a line to Wisconsin Department of Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The department started a phased approach 4 months ago to test all inmates for COVID-19. And since March, the state's dashboard shows an upward progression of positive tests. There are 231 active positive cases at the state's 37 correctional facilities. More than 2,000 inmates are in quarantine. Those figures were updated yesterday on the corrections testing dashboard. How do you want to see the Department of Corrections addressing COVID at its facilities? Is your loved one incarcerated? What are they saying about conditions? We're at 800-642-1234. Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate, and good morning to all your listeners.
Well, let's start with these active positive cases that are trending upward, 231 now. What is your department doing to help contain the spread of this outbreak?
Well, you know, Kate, we're doing the things that we have been doing since the start of the pandemic. We activated our Emergency Operations Command Center in the spring to respond to this crisis, and our EOC has coordinated our agency's response, and that team's done a fantastic job. In addition, we've taken a lot of precautions, including cleaning protocol changes, decreased movement of persons in our care, although because of the pandemic, we've had to suspend some of our programming and switch from in-person visitation to Zoom visitation, for instance, which has helped our persons in our care stay in contact with their loved ones. And the mass testing and in combination with the other testing regimens that we have in place, along with quarantining and isolation, that has been working pretty well for us. If you look at, our rate of positive cases in our system in the state of Wisconsin when compared to other states in the Midwest, we're doing very, very well.
How does sending an inmate into isolation for COVID, how is that different than sending them into solitary confinement, which is a form of punishment in correctional facilities?
Well, because we try to provide as many of the normal activities as much as possible when we move people from general population into quarantine and isolation. Now, because of the nature of their illness, in some of our facilities, they have to, when we transfer folks, they need to go to what is called a wet cell, a location that has bathroom facilities and a sink and running water. In some of our facilities where there is, where we primarily operate in a dormitory style, the only places available are either in the infirmary or in isolation type settings in order to isolate and quarantine people from the general population. So, it's something that we, reluctantly do, but it is a matter of what types of spaces are available for us to utilize.
So it's basically based on the facility construction as to how you go about quarantining and isolating, because it may not be that you have many options due to the facility itself?
That's right. Due to the operation and structure and bed assignments and design of the facility.
How often are inmates being tested?
Right now, we have a mass testing regimen that we have put together with the assistance of the National Guard and DHS that has a schedule of when we are going to do rounds of mass testing at any one of our facilities. Now, that being said, whenever we see that there's an outbreak occurring at any one specific facility, we redirect that testing activity to that facility to try to identify those who are positive as soon as possible so that we can quarantine and isolate them so that we can contain the virus as quickly as possible. Additionally, anybody who is symptomatic at any one of our facilities, they're tested and then quarantined and isolated in order for us to, again, mitigate the spread of the virus.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr about COVID-19 in our state correctional facilities, taking your questions, your situation. Do you live in a county where a juvenile detention center is set to be established? How do you feel about that? What do you think about how the Department of Corrections is addressing COVID-19 at its facilities? We're at 800-642-1234. Secretary Carr, let's go to Green Bay Correctional Institute, which has hundreds of positive tests for COVID among inmates. What is going on there?
Well, you know, again, when I talked about specific facilities that could have a spike, Green Bay Correctional did have a spike about 3 weeks ago. And at one point, we identified as many as 270 or so individuals out of, I think, about 1,100 that were tested positive, but they were all confined to one specific location in the facility. Now, that being said, today, well, and you saw the numbers, they're on our website, you know, Green Bay has a total of 37 folks who have tested positive for COVID-19. So that's a drastic reduction from where we were 2 to 3 weeks ago.
How important is it for you to have the National Guard help you in getting these specimens collected?
Our partnership with the National Guard is really a godsend. It's very important to us in order for us to have the resources to perform mass testing on the scale that it's being performed. So our relationship with the National Guard has never been better, and I thank General Mapp every chance I get for, you know, the help that he's provided the Department of Corrections during this pandemic.
You know, prison overcrowding is a problem here in our state. It's a problem nationwide. How do you prevent the spread of COVID when our correctional facilities are over capacity in the first place?
You know, it's not easy. But, you know, I think that, first of all, you have to have smart, dedicated staff that work hard every day to try to do their best to keep the persons in our care and their coworkers safe. You know, we do testing of our staff as they report to work, temperature testing, and then assessments when they walk in the door at our facilities. We routinely test the staff and persons in our care. You know, we, like I said, we isolate and quarantine when it's appropriate, and we're very proactive in that regard. And I think that we've been doing a really good job at mitigating the spread of the virus. When I look at what is happening in other systems like ours all around the country.
We have Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr as we check in on how facilities are managing the spread of COVID-19. Do you work at a correctional facility? What precautions are you seeing being taken? Do you live near a state prison? Do you worry about COVID-19 cases there? Join in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Secretary Kevin Carr here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing developments within the Corrections Department and efforts to limit the spread of COVID-19. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin National Guard has assisted in testing collection across the state, including at correctional facilities. As we've been talking about this week, Guard members are operating collection sites at Chippewa Valley, Oak Hill, Oregon, Thompson, and Racine correctional facilities, as well as Grow Academy Youth Facility. What do you want to know about testing, quarantine, and conditions inside facilities? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr, who stays with us. Let's take a call now. Jen is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
So I have a son who is in the correctional institution, and I've been very happy with what I've heard of the response so far, and for keeping him safe. But I do know that in his institution, there have been spikes where they've been put in isolation and taken back out. And he has a coexisting mental health condition. And when this is all going on, I can see his mental health struggles starting to happen. And there have been times when social workers haven't been available due to the quarantine. I'm just wondering what is being done to help support the mental health of many of our inmates during this.
Well, thanks for your question, Jen. And I can certainly tell you that those who suffer from mental illness who are in custody are of utmost importance to our administration, and we pay a lot of attention to their needs. Of course, during the pandemic, some of our resources have been strained, but we're doing everything that we can to provide more mental health services. In fact, one of the things that we have taken advantage of is the use of technology. And we're where we do have just a, and I'm just going to be honest with you, you know, there is a shortage of, there's a number of vacancies in the mental health field in the Department of Corrections. It's difficult to recruit psychiatrists and psychologists to work for DOC for a number of reasons, because the market is shrinking and the demand is extremely high all over the state. But we are looking to use telemedicine in a way that will provide access to mental health resources and counseling and what have you all over the state. And we've already started implementing that, and we hope to expand that effort as we move forward.
Where have you started it mostly? Have you been focused on particular facilities for telehealth?
No. Well, there have been a number of facilities, and I can't name them off the top of my head for you today, that have already been using telehealth. But I can tell you that just like with using Zoom as a technological resource to provide visiting opportunities to the persons in our care as opposed to in-person visiting, we've also done that telehealth and used technology in our Department of Community Corrections and in our Division of Adult Institutions in order to make the availability of medical resources greater.
Secretary Carr, what is your policy on mask wearing inside these correctional facilities?
Well, currently, you know, when it comes to wearing masks, all of our staff are required to wear masks when they get on the premises and they enter the building. That is just a fact. Now, the persons in our care are encouraged to wear a mask at all times when they are not in their private sleeping quarters.
How much compliance are you seeing?
Pardon?
How much compliance are you getting among your staff? And are inmates wearing masks when they are in groups?
Yes, they are. For the most part, I have not heard of any instances where there was a great deal of noncompliance in either the category of staff or persons in our care.
COVID-19, Secretary, has disproportionately affected communities of color. The Department of Corrections does not currently display the demographic data of people who have contracted COVID in your facilities. Why not disclose that data?
Well, that's an interesting idea. And, I'm not a person that's afraid to say, I don't know. I don't know why we don't display the demographic data about race as it breaks down to who's positive and who isn't. But that's something we'll take a look at.
We're talking with the Secretary of the Department of Corrections, Kevin Carr, getting your questions and insights. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Secretary Carr, let's look at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake here for a moment. We're seeing the lowest number of youth inmates in years. What is this due to? Because youth were last checked into these facilities, I understand, in late March.
Could you repeat that question, Kate?
Sure. I want to talk about Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which is seeing their lowest number of youth inmates in years. What does that due to?
Oh, well, you know, I think it's due to a number of factors. We have not been able to identify one specific driver for the reduction in our juvenile population at Lincoln Hills, but we've had some discussions around it, and I think a lot of it has to do with different decisions that the counties are making on how they want to manage their juvenile youth issues.
Where are you at with the closure of Lincoln Hills as we see, a number of these counties, Brown, Dane, Milwaukee, pulling back from their involvement in a plan to try to create smaller facilities as Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake is on a track to close?
Right. Well, I'm glad you asked that question because just last week, the Department of Corrections met with the counties involved and the Wisconsin Counties Association to discuss exactly where we are with the 185 and the CERCES, the Secure Residential Care Centers for Youth and Children. Now, for children and youth. Now, during our meeting, they expressed some concerns that I think really reflect gaps in the legislation that need to be addressed before they feel comfortable moving forward. For instance, some of the concerns they expressed were about startup costs for the facilities, potential operating losses, you know, the unrealistic timelines, and the lack of funding for the type ones and those issues. So the legislature had the opportunity to address these issues with a trailer bill that they passed last year, but didn't do so. And in October of last year, I submitted a request to the legislature, really to the Joint Finance Committee, for funding for the Type 1 facilities as anticipated by Act 185, and they declined to approve that funding request in February.
And explain what you mean by Type 1 facilities.
Well, a Type 1 facility is a facility that is intended to house and manage serious juvenile offenders.
So as you look at the situation with COVID and, you know, falling tax revenues, county, state budget extremely tight or in uncharted territory, what does that mean for the closure of Lincoln Hills?
Pardon?
So as we look at budgets...
I'm having trouble
here.
Sure.
That's okay. So as you look at the budget situation at the county level and at the state level and the falling revenue and falling tax revenue, what does that make for your plan to close Lincoln Hills, which is going to need a lot of startup revenue?
Well, obviously, revenues on both the state and the county levels have been impacted by the current pandemic, and how much impact that's having on the county's decisions to move forward with the services is really an unknown to me. That has not been identified by any of them as a specific reason why they are asking to defer. And I want to make a clarification. Of course, the counties involved in this in Act 185 are Milwaukee, Brown, Racine, and Dane. Racine County is moving ahead, and we're currently negotiating the necessary contracts with Racine County. Brown, Dane, and Milwaukee have all asked to defer their acceptance of the grant until some of these issues that I identified earlier are worked out.
Secretary Carr, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Kevin, take care. To you too. Kevin Carr, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Coming up, we talk with a WPR reporter about private well water testing in southwestern Wisconsin and the continued work by scientists to trace contamination in private wells. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about private well testing in several southwestern Wisconsin counties, Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists have completed their fourth and final round of private well sampling to identify sources of contamination. The study that goes by the acronym SWIG started 2 years ago. Do you live in these counties? Was your well tested? Is it contaminated? Join in at 800-642-1234. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior, and she's been reporting on this final round of private well testing research. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
So as researchers have completed this fourth and final round of private well sampling, what have they found?
Well, they found that altogether by sampling these wells that were previously flagged for contamination, I just want to point that out, these were wells that were known to have issues. They found that across these four rounds of sampling that 76% had fecal contamination from humans or livestock.
Okay, so they're finding consistently on round after round of sampling that there is this contamination. What is going on? How is this fecal contamination happening?
Well, I mean, if it's from humans or livestock, obviously those are the sources, but they don't really have a good idea yet how it's getting into those wells. I mean, we can make some assumptions, but they're going to be looking at risk factors for well contamination coming up. You know, in the beginning of this study, they looked at more than 800 wells and sampled them, and they found excess levels of coliform bacteria, which is an indicator of fecal matter that may be harmful, or bacteria being present that may be harmful. And they also had excess levels of nitrate. So for these 76% of wells that were previously flagged to have this, it's not really unexpected because we knew that they were already contaminated. But it's a little bit different because you might have thought that all of the wells would have had fecal contamination, but that's not the case. You know, most of them do from these four sampling rounds, but the others may have just had high nitrate levels, or the conditions may have changed in the meantime.
Why does a sampling have to occur over years? I mean, why couldn't you do one-stop shop sampling and be able to get some results? Why did they have to go back again and again?
Well, I think the idea is that they wanted to do this over time at different times of year because they wanted to catch these wells at different times and at different conditions. You know, for example, in the springtime, we see typically wetter conditions, and that's when we see some spreading, manure spreading, because they can't spread during the winter, or it's limited. And so, you know, the idea is that maybe there are times of the year where there's more risk for contamination. But during these sampling rounds, they really didn't have the kind of wet conditions that we've seen in Wisconsin in recent years. So they weren't able to get a good idea of whether or not that played a role.
Can you rewind for us all the way back to the beginning and explain how the study started? What led researchers to even begin testing these wells in these three counties?
Yeah, so Iowa Grant in Lafayette counties funded this study, which you said is called SWIG, a couple of years ago because of growing concerns about groundwater contamination across the state. You know, we've seen areas in northeastern Wisconsin that have had issues with nitrate contamination, particularly Kewaunee County. And there's been similar research there to look at contamination and the sources of contamination and what factors can increase that risk. And, you know, the research that was done there led the state to take some policy changes. They, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, enacted some manure spreading restrictions across 15 counties in northeastern Wisconsin that were found to be susceptible to this type of contamination because of manure runoff and in this area where they have fractured bedrock, which means that it's more likely to get into the groundwater supply there.
Oh, so the topography of the land itself could perhaps be causing this leaching of contaminants?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain factors with the geology that could put some places in Wisconsin more at risk than others because, you know, in northeastern Wisconsin and in southwestern Wisconsin, there are areas where we see what are called karst features that can lead to sinkholes. And so, you know, it just makes these areas more vulnerable to whatever is happening on the land getting into the water supply.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Danielle Kading. She is a WPR reporter, and she's been following the results of private well water testing in southwestern Wisconsin, a study now that's been going on 2 years. It's called SWIG. That's its acronym. You can join in. Do you live in Grant, Iowa, or Lafayette counties? Have you been following the developments in the water study? What questions do you have about the findings? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Danny, the DNR says private wells need to be tested annually. Do we know anything about the wells that the researchers, the scientists studied in this particular study as to how often these wells were being tested?
Well, I don't. but, you know, they do recommend that testing. And it's not required. Only public water supplies are required to test wells for the presence of contaminants. You know, private well owners are responsible for maintaining their own water supplies. So, and, you know, it's really up to them if they want to know what's happening with their water. And that can be that can be tough. You know, sometimes it might be an issue of cost for them. If they're, you know, like say they find out that they have nitrate contamination or they have high levels of fecal bacteria, you know, then they would have to look at some sort of treatment or maybe even bottled water. And, you know, that's an extra cost for these homeowners or drilling a new well. You know, there's a lot of things that might prevent people from taking those steps.
Has there been any public health efforts in Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties to help these landowner homeowners understand, you know, just the health risks of this type of contamination? Do you know any efforts there?
Well, I think that this study is really what they see as an education effort to get residents more aware of the fact that, you know, these types of contaminants might be present in their private wells. And so by doing this study, I think they're hoping that people will be more aware of the issues that they might confront and take those steps to test and be proactive about, you know, ensuring whether or not they have safe drinking water.
Do we know what the SWIG researchers, the scientists, will do with the results from this latest round of testing?
Well, so the researchers are sharing this information with all the landowners who take part and with the counties that are involved. And then those counties hope to use this information to kind of guide any decisions that they might make at the local level. And it really depends on, you know, this final stage of the study that's going to kick off here, where they're looking at different factors that could increase the risk of contamination.
What might those factors be that could increase the risk of contaminants getting into these private water wells?
Yeah, so some of the risks involved could be, you know, where these wells are located and how close they are to farm fields. You know, that was something that they found in northeastern Wisconsin, that the proximity of these wells to farm fields increased the risk for contamination there. It might be the number and concentration of septic systems near wells. It could be the age or the depth of a well. So all of those can be factors that could possibly increase the risk of contamination.
Can counties or municipalities in any way mandate inspection or testing of private wells? Has that been tried anywhere?
I really don't know the answer to that question, Kate.
Yeah. So as you look at this study, do you find that the scientists are making progress from one round of sampling to the next? Is their data consistent?
I'm sorry. What do you mean by that, I guess?
Well, I mean, is the trends of the contamination from each round of testing, is that consistent from one round to the next? Does that bear out in the data?
Yes, because these four rounds of sampling, again, were from previously flagged wells. These are wells that in this first phase of the study that they tested and found that they had excess levels of either nitrate that were unsafe, or they had excess levels of coliform bacteria that, again, are this indicator that other harmful fecal bacteria might be present.
Let's take a call now. Roberta is joining us from Iowa County. Hi, Roberta.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I live in Iowa. Iowa County. I want to know, how do I get my well water tested for these contaminants? And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thank you, Roberta. Yes, Danny, go ahead.
Yeah, I would recommend getting in touch with the county or with the Wisconsin DNR. I'm sure that they would have all the information that you would need. So, like, if you're in Iowa County, I would contact the Iowa County Conservationist. I'm sure she could direct you to that information of how to get your well sampled or tested.
WPR reporter Danielle Kading is our guide to the SWIG scientists who have analyzed samples from private wells in southwestern Wisconsin. Are you living in an area of the state that has had issues accessing clean water? What questions do you have about sources of contamination? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Danny Kading here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with WPR reporter Danielle Kading. She's been covering the outcome of the SWIG study as scientists sample dozens of private wells in several southwestern Wisconsin counties looking for contaminants from people, contaminants from cattle, swine, in the water. The study's final report is expected. It's due out next year. So, Danny, zoom out for us, if you will. How many Wisconsin residents have private wells that they use to get their water, their cooking, their cleaning, drinking?
Right. Okay. So about 4 million or so Wisconsin residents get their water from public water supplies. But according to the Wisconsin DNR, around 30% of Wisconsin residents get their water from private wells.
And in the area that was tested in southwestern Wisconsin, how prevalent are these private water wells?
Yeah, about 44% of residents in these three counties get their water from private wells.
Okay. So when you look at the study of these wells that's been going on now for a couple of years, how has it been affected by the coronavirus pandemic?
Oh, yeah. So the final round of sampling and the release of those, that was delayed a bit by the pandemic because of lab work. You know, right now, Mark Borkhart, who's the USDA microbiologist that's working on the study, you know, he said that they only are allowed to have one person in the lab right now. And so that kind of just slows everything down as they're trying to analyze their findings.
We got a call from Tom, called in to share that Tom lives in a small southwestern Wisconsin town, and Tom gets yearly results of private well testing, but results seem to be behind a few years. Tom says, how accurate is well testing across the state? How is it handled differently in different regions?
Oh, I wish I could answer that question. I really just don't have a good answer to that.
Yeah, so there could be, though, a lag in data when it comes to well testing. And certainly, as the scientists here have done, this has been years, the SWIG study. It's not something that you can just pop in and pop out and get results.
Well, I mean, this testing, this final round that came out, you know, these were samples that were taken from previously collected samples. So these samples were selected in March, but yes, they were selected from previous rounds of testing. So, you know, conditions, like I said before, may have changed during that time. You know, if things get wet or if things get dry, or if the land use changes in the area or anything else that might play a role in the contamination of these wells.
Danny, what will improvements look like for Wisconsin residents who have private wells that are contaminated with fecal matter? I mean, how do you take steps to mitigate that?
Well, I mean, I guess the improvements, though, really depend on what the researchers find, because, I mean, I wouldn't want to say to somebody right now that, you know, if you're afraid that you have contamination, go and drill a deeper well. We don't know that that would fix the issue. So, I mean, the solution really depends on the outcome of the study's findings where they're looking at those risk factors. You know, I mean, if proximity to farm fields plays a role, then, you know, it might take regulation by either the state or at the local level to try and prevent contamination of the water supply from farm fields, just like what happened in northeastern Wisconsin. So I don't know that there's like a specific answer that I could give right now about what the solution would be.
What of the residents whose wells were found to be contaminated, what have they been told to do?
I actually am not sure. Like when I talked to Iowa County, for example, you know, one of the questions that I had was if people who had found this contamination were now treating or taking up some other sorts of steps. And I was told that some are trying to disinfect their wells, but I don't know that that's something that is being followed up on.
Well, Dave from Spooner called in, couldn't stay with us. And Dave is wondering if there's a statewide approach to these water well challenges between Kewaunee, Milwaukee, and southwestern Wisconsin. Dave says there is a lot going on. And Dave is also wondering how the geology and soil of a region can help or hurt water quality and contamination in these wells.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the statewide approach because, you know, because the geology is so different in every part of the state, a one size fits all kind of solution, I don't think is going to work for the state based on what we know. But there are efforts at the state level to look at, you know, site-specific standards to control nitrate contamination. That's something that went before the Natural Resources Board in the last year. And so that's something that's being examined. The geology across the state, like, for example, northeastern and southwestern Wisconsin share some of the similar characteristics because they have the same type of rock, this dolomite rock. But they have other types of geologic formations too, including sandstone and shale units. But all of these have the potential, they all have fractures in them. So that makes them, these areas, more susceptible to this contamination. In other areas of the state, that might not be the case.
We're talking with Danielle Kading, who is a WPR reporter based in Superior, and she's been following the results, the latest round of private well water testing in southwestern Wisconsin. Still time to talk about it. How would you like to see policymakers address these private well water issues? Have you noticed any changes in your own water since the pandemic started or before? And if you live in Grant, Iowa, or Lafayette counties, have you been following the developments in this SWIG water study? Join in at 800-642-1234. Danny, how specifically are lawmakers in the state responding to these problems with private wells?
Well, so the contamination, the first part of the study that showed 42% of, I think it was, is it 300 or so wells? Mm-hmm. That prompted the Assembly Speaker Robin Voss to create a water quality task force last year. And so a bipartisan group of lawmakers went across the state holding meetings, trying to get information from people. And then those meetings ended up producing a package of more than a dozen bills that sought to address some of these water quality concerns all across the state. Those bills were approved by the Assembly earlier this year, or most of them were, but they were not taken up by the state Senate. And so they died in the legislature.
And so basically at now, those lawmakers are dead until maybe they would be revived in the next session.
Yeah. And both Democrats and Republicans who were on that task force are hopeful and expect that those bills would be reintroduced in the next legislative session.
So what is the timeline here for the final report and conclusion of the SWIG study?
Well, researchers are going to be, again, looking at those risk factors for well contamination right now and, collecting information on well construction reports and the number of septic systems in the area and all of that information I mentioned before. And so they're going to be going through that and compiling information, and then they hope to issue their findings sometime next year.
Will it contain recommendations on what to do next?
I don't think that the researchers would say that it's their job to recommend policy. I think what they would say is, we're giving you this information that tells you where the risks are. It's up to policymakers and the counties to decide whether or not they want to use that to take steps to manage the problem.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a Wisconsin Public Radio radio reporter based in Superior. Just ahead, we talk about the struggles that parents are facing as they try to help their child stay on track with virtual learning. Is your child learning from home? How is it going? How are you doing in helping to assist your child in these virtual studies? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.